Yes. In Buddhism, Jainism, Vedanta, Yoga, in all these traditions, life is not one chance. So, depending upon our deeds, our actions in this life, we'll be born again. So we, and what we do in this life, our actions will produce an effect, an impact, we may call, a residual element. It's called apurva or adrishta, invisible. You can see in our own life, when we do something good, that good action produces a tendency to repeat the same action if that good action was a pleasant one. Suppose by doing good you feel a great peace of mind, then you have a tendency, a desire to do it again. Now, apart from its immediate, visible, tangible consequences, these actions have an invisible after result. And that is in the form of samskara, a tendency. And it will remain with you, and you will be born again with the same tendency. Good tendency or bad tendency. So this cycle will continue till you reach liberation. So liberation in Vedanta and Yoga means when we realize that this body is all right, but it is not immortal. This mind also is a changeable thing. So it is not immortal, not eternal. There is something that goes beyond mind, beyond body, beyond intellect, which is called Atman, self or soul in Vedanta. And that is eternal immortal. Once you realize this, then you have no more rebirth. So this state is called Nirvana in Buddhist tradition. Nirvana also is this transcendental experience. In Vedanta, it's called moksha or liberation. So once we reach this level of freedom, then we get freedom from this wheel, this cycle of birth, life, death, and rebirth. That's why you find that some people with strong tendencies, good tendencies. If you in a family where five children, they grow in the same family under identical conditions, they go to the same school, go to the same college, but five children have five totally different tendencies. How do you explain this in terms of genetics? So Vedanta says these five children are five individual souls. They had lived in the past when their parents were different, but they themselves have accumulated their own samskaras, their own impressions, tendencies through their actions. With that they are born. So rebirth is an important doctrine in Vedanta, Yoga, and Buddhism, and law of karma. Incidentally, it is written in some books that the law of karma and rebirth were accepted even in early Christianity before the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, when you were put to vote, when the church got divided into two factions, you know. So it was rejected on the majority of votes. So if you read Plato, you read the early Greek mystery religions, you find the traces of the strong belief in rebirth and love karma. So I get that. Maybe it was for theological benefit they may have done away with this doctrine. Maybe so. Okay.
So one question was that earlier you mentioned that, you know, that God helps you in so many different ways. Yeah. And the person who is obsessed with wealth and become arrogant and all this, they lose their... So God takes away the wealth. And in a way, the person at that time feels it's a big punishment to them. And they lose confidence in God at that point, for example. Yeah. So what keeps the faith alive in those situations?
So God doesn't bother about those who have not reached a very high level of spiritual evolution, so that they feel that is a punishment. Those who have not reached that level of spiritual evolution, God will let them play with their money as much as possible. But those who have reached a still higher level of spiritual evolution, then only God interferes. Well, I should help this man. And that person will not take it as a punishment. He will, that experience of losing money for which he worked so hard, instead of causing him to lose his faith in God, will open his inner eye. I made a mistake by being arrogant. So this is the right that I deserved. So you find the lives of some of the householder disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. Fine. So again, people belong to different levels of spiritual evolution. Those who reach a higher level of spiritual evolution will not feel this a punishment, because along with this experience, that person realizes, oh yes, I got this and I deserved. Maybe it's good for me. You know, I told you the story of Parikshit. The early story, remind this is a very interesting illustrative. It's the right answer to your question. You know, there was a great king, Parikshit, who was really a great king, but he made a mistake. One day he was traveling in a forest. He entered a hermitage where an old hermit saint was meditating. The hermit did not recognize him. He was immersed in meditation. So the king thought that man was arrogant, so I must teach him a lesson. He was a good man, but he was a noble king, but he made a mistake at that point, weak, unguarded moment. So he looked around, he found a dead snake lying there, took it with his bow and put it on the neck of this hermit and went away. And the hermit's son came and found his father sitting there, a stinking dead snake. So he cursed the man who did this. On that seventh day from now, this man will die and will be bitten by a poisonous snake. That's the curse. Now, when this message was transmitted to the king immediately, yes, I made a mistake. I should not have done it. I should not have insulted the great sage meditating in a cave. So I deserve this. I deserve this punishment. What he did, he had only 7 days to live. He left his palace, left his comforts, went to the banks of Ganga, and there he decided to sit in meditation for 7 days till his death. So instead of punishing the sage, he had a different impact on his mind. It opened his inner eye, because he was really a great man, but in one unguarded moment, he happened to commit this heinous sin. So you find he had reached a very high level of spiritual evolution. So instead of getting angry with the hermit for cursing him, what he did, yes, I deserve this. So he left everything behind, went to the bank of Ganga and sat there in meditation. In a way, that curse became a blessing to him, because he became a wise man. That will be the effect of real spiritual seekers when they have this. See, those who never meditate, those who never practice spiritual things, no, God will not take away their money. They will give him a little more, let them have it as much as possible. Because it will crush them. It will make them angry. They may become atheists. So he will have plenty of it. So it depends upon the spiritual evolution of the person. That's the idea.
I read in Sri Ramakrishna's gospel that bhakti yoga is somewhat better for ordinary people than jnana yoga. Can you comment on that one?
Yeah. Now, yes, in Sri Ramakrishna's teachings, he makes it very clear that bhakti, or the path of devotion, and the path of knowledge are the same in their most advanced state. Of course, this is the original statement comes in Shankaracharya's commentary. So, Maisha Aninne Yogena Bhakti Ravibhijarini Vivikta Desha Sevitum Anabhirjana Samsa. This is the 10th verse of 13th chapter in Gita. So in the commentary, Shankaracharya says, the highest devotion, the highest knowledge are the same, Sacha Jnanam. He describes the highest devotion. And then finally he says, the highest path of devotion and knowledge are the same at the experience level. But then Sri Ramakrishna says in the Gospel, for people, not for all, but people who have less faith and who have a lot of things to do, for them, bhakti yoga is easier. But what he meant by bhakti yoga is bhakti yoga combined with karma yoga. So Sri Ramakrishna's Gospel, there is always an insistence on doing our duty to the best of our ability with a sense of total unselfishness. Along with that, you offer the results of what you do to God. So it is a kind of a synthesis of bhakti and karma yoga in the Gospel. That is true. But he doesn't say everyone should follow that. Sri Ramakrishna recommended all the three paths according to her temperament. But in this age, Narada's school of bhakti is easier to follow, because if you can completely surrender everything to God sincerely, then it's easier for us to do our duties as an offering to God in that sense. Senses do not become spiritual. They are neither spiritual nor secular. What we do, we give our natural tendencies to do, to act, to work, a spiritual direction. So that's what we do. Eyes, sense of touch, sense of sound, sense of smell, sense of sight, and so on, they normally drag the mind in so many different directions. So we must make an effort as far as possible to give them a spiritual direction. Along with seeing many other things, let us also use the eye to see great good things which will be helpful in spiritual life. Hearing things which will be helpful in spiritual life. Because what we see, what we hear, all this will create an impression, a vritti, vasana in our mind. So to create good vasanas, good tendencies, good impressions, we must direct the mind and the five senses together in a spiritual direction. Give a spiritual orientation to the natural tendencies of the senses. And their work, not the senses, natural tendencies of the senses. I mean, the eyes have a tendency to go and see things. Ears have a tendency to go and hear things. So all these activities can be given a spiritual orientation, because they cannot keep quiet. If you don't give a spiritual orientation, they will take their own direction. So once we make an effort to give a spiritual direction to them, it will have a soothing effect on the mind. That's the impact.
Swamiji, you had me on this side. You had talked about the 10 paths, I think you called them Yama, Niyama.
Yeah.
Can you give us a short exposition on the practical ways to go about this?
Yes, no. Yeah, these 10 fundamental disciplines are explained in the second chapter of Padanjali Yoga Sutra, Sadhana Pada. So they are the two fundamental disciplines of Ashtanga Yoga. Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, Samadhi. Okay. Yama and Niyama are the most important preparatory disciplines, which are not necessarily related to yoga alone, but for whole spiritual life, not only spiritual life, secular life also. So yama has got five components: ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, parigraha. This is yamas, which is universal. Ahimsa means non-violence. Not necessarily not doing violent deeds, but completely abstaining from violent thoughts, violent words, violent actions, being established in the ideal of non-violence. So that is ahimsa. Satya means truthfulness. What we think in our mind, what we do, what we act, when they are in the same line, it is called satya. Asteya means, practically means not taking what doesn't belong to us. Tendency, greed. Brahmacharya means purity, self-control. Then aparigraha means not receiving gifts. It means non-possessiveness, a tendency, a strong desire to get things from others, to possess things that belong to others, and so on. In a kind of the ability to say no to our natural tendencies of the mind to go after different things, which may not need us all the time. Niyamas are these. Shauja, Sandosha, Tapas, Swadhyaya, Ishwara, Pranidhana. Shauja means inner mental purity and physical purity. A kind of cleanliness as an ideal. Not necessarily taking bath and things like that. Cleanliness, purity as an ideal. So Santosha is a contentment mentioned here. Okay. So when we reach that level of Santosha, Samyak Tosha means Samyak Tushyadi, means the one who is really contented. When you reach a state where you feel that you do not want to seek anything else, anything beyond that, then you become settled mentally and physically. You may do your duty, but this contentment will give you a poise, an inner tranquility. When we have a desire for things, the mind gets disturbed. The mind, when we want to do certain things, to acquire those things which we want. So when we are completely free from that desire, when you are established inner contentment, then we do not want to seek anything, then there is no more that. So there is santosha. Then tapa. Tapa means actually in control of the senses and mind. That is tapa. So shauja, tapa, swadhyaya. Swadhyaya is the fourth one. Swadhyaya means reading or understanding or listening to spiritually healthy, helpful ideas. Reading scriptures, good books, holy books that will help us to feed our mind with good, healthy impressions and tendencies and images and vasanas and samskaras. Ishwara Pradhana is an idea of surrender to God. In a way, it is a prelude to what we call confession in St. Augustine's. True confession will make you a new person. True confession is not a license renewal program. True confession will make, see what happened to St. Augustine, what happened to St. Francis of Assisi. You find many great men who had a complete transformation when they surrendered themselves to God. Actually, Patanjali says this Ishwara Pradhana, an ideal of surrender completely to God's will substitute for all other disciplines. Because when you sincerely surrender yourself to God's will, then your every action, every word, every thought will remind you, well, you have surrendered to the will of God. So the idea of God's will, God will naturally come to our mind in whatever we think, whatever we do. We can't hate anyone. We won't be able to do harm to anybody. So we will be able to look upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family. In that respect, Ishwara Pranidhanam is very important. So Patanjali says Ishwara Pranidhanam Dva. In a way, it becomes a substitute for all other nine disciplines. That's the idea. These are the Yama Niyamas. Okay.
Swamiji. mentioned about ultra pragmatism is the curse in modernity, right? To some extent, in the real life world, we live in that,
yeah,
in the
yeah.
business sense and everywhere else. Yeah. And then we go into spiritual world, and that's the meditation acts as a with the bridge to bring yeah. your mind into a different state. Yeah. So you get into the acceptance
yeah.
and follow that. And I really, one of my favorite slokas in Bhagavad Gita is Fishyasteham Shadi Mahantam Prapannam. That gives you a sense of total surrender to listen. But from a practical sense, can you guide us through some ways to orient ourselves to move from the pragmatic world to better way to get more out of the time we spend on the knowledge?
You know, pragmatism essentially takes into consideration only the demands and needs of this empirical world. Pragmatism is built upon the earlier form of utilitarianism, which is a much worse kind of thing. Maximum amount of pressure to the maximum number of people. If you read J.S. Bentham and J.S. Mill, that's the definition. So pragmatism has got a much more philosophical sounding connotation, that's true. So, and pragmatism in modern times is unavoidable. That is true. But at the same time, ultra-pragmatism, that is connecting our actions to the practical utility all the time, creates problems. So it becomes psychologically impossible for us to do anything which may not necessarily produce a beneficial result, at least in our imagination. That's the main problem. But we can never get a beneficial result for everything we do. It is impossible. So, that everyone knows. There are very many occasions when the results are beneficial, and there are many occasions where the results are not beneficial. Now, how does our mind react to situations where our actions produce the opposite results, which are not beneficial to us? So, how the mind suffers, the mind gets disappointed, gets depressed, thus it becomes totally unavoidable. So there you have to get a way out of this trap of pragmatism. How to do? You have to keep a high ideal. Pragmatism is related to the empirical world, empirical experiences. And everything at the empirical level is subject to change, pain and pleasure. The stock markets go up, they also crash. So, this is unavoidable, two sides of the same coin. This is a reality. But this reality is not taken into consideration in pragmatism. Pragmatism always take it for granted. Everything will have, should have, we want to have a beneficial result, which is totally an illusion. We are actually deceiving ourselves. But then we should recognize that there are occasions when the results are not beneficial, sometimes even harmful. And then that affects the mind. So how to solve this problem? To keep a high ideal. That is, that goes beyond empirical calculations. Calculations of this world and its duties and obligations. And what is that? You can idea spiritual ideal or unselfishness. As you mentioned, you know, the idea of surrender to God's will. So when everything goes fine, you have no problem. When something's go wrong, when something goes wrong, then what happens? Well, that also God's will. So the idea of God's will here becomes a kind of a medicine. It will have a soothing effect when you feel that the results do not tally with your expectations. So that's the idea. So idealism comes to the rescue to help you to get out of the trap of pragmatism. That's the point.
Two issues. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the Lord's Blessed Song, there's a dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna about karma.
Yeah.
Would you share with us those thoughts once again about karma-free action and not acting for the fruits of one's actions?
Yeah.
That's the first issue.
Well, in the whole, yes, I'll come to that. The whole Bhagavad Gita, the beginning of the text, Arjuna begins his dialogue, telling Krishna, see, I'm not able to act. Dushtvemam sujanam Krishna yutsum samavastidam sidanti mamagatrani mukham cha parishyushi. The 28th verse of the first chapter. It's the beginning of Arjuna's dialogue. He opens dialogue. Now, what he says is this. I'm not able to work. I'm not able to do my duty. I'm suffering from depression. It's called a withdrawal symptom. That's what modern psychiatrists diagnosed Arjuna's problem. Withdrawal symptom. Because he was a very active person with a strong idealism, very professional, very efficient. But suddenly he becomes depressed. He says that I'm not able to do anything. I cannot figure out what I want to do. That's what he says. At the end of the text, the same Arjuna, in 18th chapter, Arjuna says, I shall act according to your instruction. My doubts have gone. My conflicts have disappeared. So, nashto moha smidil labdha tat prasadar maya achyuta sidosmi gada sandeha karishi vajanantava. Now I'm free from all my doubts and conflicts. I shall act according to your instruction. Now, in the whole dialogue of Bhagavad Gita, you find four levels of evolution of in the concept of karma in Arjuna's mind. Krishna took Arjuna from the lowest level of inaction due to laziness and ignorance to the highest level of enlightened action combined with contemplation. So these are two high ideals. At the lowest level, Arjuna was suffering from ignorance, depression, inaction, laziness, all that. Krishna tells him, inaction due to laziness, running away from your duties and responsibilities, is the worst thing that you can have. It's far better to do your duty with a strong will, with a strong determination, with a strong ambition, with strong desire, than to do nothing, sitting there, keeping quiet. This is a point to understand. Krishna does not necessarily tell Arjuna about karma yoga at the beginning. What Krishna does is to lift Arjuna from a state of total inertia, ignorance, stupidity, to a level of action with desire, workaholism, professionalism, efficiency. That is Rajoguna. And then Krishna tells him the third stage. Action, workaholism, efficiency, success, that alone are not enough. Because many people who are very successful take sleeping pills, suffer from depression, anxiety, neurosis, and so on. So you have to combine action with yoga. Karma should be combined with yoga. So the third stage, Krishna tells him, you should work with efficiency, work with enthusiasm, with a definite goal, but no desire, no attachment. You should work with a sense of non-attachment, but you should not compromise on efficiency, your enterprise, your dedication. No compromise. Because efficiency, action, success, the desire produce problems. So, and attachment produce problems. So the same efficiency, the same strong dedication to work and workaholism, minus attachment, minus desire, will save you from the problems of success, problems of abundance. Yesterday I mentioned, This is the third stage, karma yoga. At the fourth stage, Krishna says, when you reach this level of karma yoga, when you get fully established, when you become naturally unselfish in doing your duty, then every act becomes an act of worship. Every thought becomes an act of meditation. And whole life becomes a spiritual offering to God. This is the last stage. So Gandhiji used to refer to the last stage. Gandhi was a really humble man, if you read my experiments with truth, if you understand. He had to go through all these different levels of evolution, right from the most from the early, the primitive, the beginning of spiritual life. And he went step by step the higher stage. He could breathe his last with the name of God in his lips because he was established in what he called Anasakti Yoga, the doctrine of unselfish action, total non-attachment. So that's why he could enjoy so much of inner contentment and peace that he could even face death with a smile, without inner disturbance. He didn't smile, of course, but when he was not disturbed, when he was in a state of complete poise and tranquility. See, there's a four levels of evolution in the doctrine, in the concept of karma and the Gita. I mean, first, total inaction, which is the most despicable, the lowest ideal that everyone should avoid. Second stage, action with desire, action with a definite goal, action with attachment, karma. Third stage, action without desire, but the same level of efficiency, professionalism, and attachment. Last, when you reach a stage when you become naturally unselfish in whatever you do, when whole life becomes a spiritual sadhana, spiritual practice. The four levels.
The next issue is rather existentialistic.
Okay.
Seeking a Vedanta perspective, an answer on this. There are many world conflicts, and from a physician's point of view, even though without being a physician, they seem pathological. They're disturbing. They're psychiatric disorders and so on and so forth. And without even taking sides, and it seems like humanity is hurting itself. What is the motivation behind this? Who is to profit from human suffering? What is the best attitude to take without taking sides?
Well, all that we can do is to practice in our own subjective life some of these spiritual ideas and to discuss these spiritual ideas with fellow seekers. If you want to help the world, it's a very big task. But then even the idea that the world is suffering, that is a nobility associated with it. In fact, that produces a good inner residual effect, you know, vritti or samskarasana. But at the same time, we should remember, ultimately, we can only reform ourselves. As spiritual seekers, all that we can do is to promote these ideas and to get more people drawn towards these ideas, to spread the higher spiritual ideas. That's all we can do. To increase the number of people who share your views to begin with. That's the one way we can do. As in a way, you know, if you read the newspapers, if you see the TV, if you look at the news items, information, then you find that you're right, the world is facing a terrible psychiatric problem. But then it's so huge and the world is 8 billion population. There's not much we can do about it. So all that we can do is to spread these great ideas. That's all we can do at the subjective level. It's true, yes. So...
Do you have time for one last question?
Okay, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Just very far, quick, okay, please.
My question is this. Well, first of all, thank you for this incredible retreat. It's just been
thank you, so honoring
of all our spiritual questions, and it feels like such a sacred space
for this
to happen. My question is this, and also I really loved your response to this gentleman's question about the four steps of karma yoga in the Gita. I still have this big problem with the Gita, and that is Krishna's response to Arjuna as far as going to war with his family. and I know it's very metaphysical, but I don't get something, okay? So my question is...
Can you give the mic to... It's not very... Not easy.
Hi. Oh, here it is. It's working. So my question is, I can't like integrate the Sermon on the Mount with the Gita. You know, okay, so this is sort of my, because I'm trying to express my question as lucidly as possible, and last night it occurred to me, it's like...
Because we have little time, it's already 5 minutes, 8 minutes over, you know.
Oh, okay.
So we are supposed to speak, we are supposed to conclude at 11:30, it's almost 11:35.
Okay. Can I ask a question quickly?
But I shall answer the part of question that you mentioned, okay. The Sermon on the Mount and the Bhagavad Gita you're mentioning, you know. I gave a talk recently on this subject on last Sunday, 25th. Now, one reason why many of us cannot fully integrate these two great spiritual classics is this. We sometimes try to look at the universal ideas through the prism of the relative, non-universal, socio-anthropological, cultural prism. See, in both these texts, there are great humility. You find surrender. If you serve others, if you do good to others, you will be enriched. So, many of these ideas, spiritual ideas, you find in both these texts. So, if you find differences, it's because sometimes we may not be always able to focus on the universal. Or we may try to interpret the universal through the non-universal idea. See, if you read the Bible, you find from a socio-anthropological point of view, the imageries, the parables, the examples, the vocabulary, all these belong to a culture which is distant and different from the culture in which Gita was preached. So the parables, imageries, illustrations, and examples, the pastoral culture. I mean, the background of Judeo-Christian tradition, all these are natural, but they are secondary components of the classic. The fundamental theme of the classic is the divinity of God, God's compassion, all these great spiritual ideas. Those ideas you find in Gita also. Or whatever you find in Gita, in a different language, you find in the Bible also, especially in the universal themes like Sermon on the Mount, many of the parables like that. So we have to focus on the universal, and we should take care not to interpret the universal through the prism, or interpreting the language of the non-universal, the cultural, the national, the socio-anthropological. They belong to the non-universal, the secondary details. So perhaps some other time, I'll be happy to listen and discuss with you these subjects. You're right. But then we should understand the universal is what we must focus on. That must we have to keep in mind. Then if we read, you find great spiritual ideas in both the scriptures. That's the idea. Spiritual ideas are found in these great scriptures. But the language and vocabulary may be different. Frequently there is difficulty. That's true, you're right, to understand the universal implication of many of the terms. So I'd be happy to discuss with you, listen to your ideas, very wonderful ideas. Thank you. So now we will conclude. And because just for want of time, it's a very interesting subject you raised. Perhaps you could have raised yesterday, it would have been wonderful. So now after this, we will have refreshments. Then from 12 to 12:30, we will have meditation in this auditorium. Of course, not here in the main temple lecture hall auditorium as we had yesterday. So thank you and welcome, all of you welcome. You're welcome to attend our other programs, Sundays, Fridays, classes and lectures. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Dasat Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa.